This will be the last presentation. It's a step back. Instead of looking at a specific element of literature or a specific genre, what we want to do today is talk about what's known as literary unity. The fact that the Bible, although it was written over 2,000 years, it's made up of 66 books written by various authors, everybody from shepherds to kings, written in several languages, written on more than one continent across a wide swath of the earth. All of these things, you would think you'd end up with an utter mishmash of concepts and religions and themes and things like that, and that's not true. The Bible is a unified work despite all of these problems in its construct. And so some people actually see it as a sign that the Bible is supernatural. They say, well, what other books can you think of that you could group together, written over that period of time, that many books, written by that many authors in different languages on several continents, and come up with the kind of unity that you find in the Bible? So let's take a look at the ways the Bible is unified and that why we can call it the Bible rather than a bunch of books about God. So here we go. Here's some ways that it's unified. Well, for one thing, it tells a single story, doesn't it? And what's that story? Well, it's God at the beginning. Man comes into the picture, messes things up. God deals with the human race through one specific group, the Jews, to try to set things back right again. So we have the fall of the human race, the working out of the solution. That's the whole story. God is the protagonist. It's a clash of good and evil. It's a failure and then an attempt to set it right throughout the rest of the story. So a single story here. Secondly, the Bible is unified because of its religious orientation. In other words, it believes that there is a supernatural world. It believes that in the supernatural world there is a God. And this is a God that created everything. It believes there really is such a thing as good and evil. Now, let's stop there for just a second. If you don't believe there's a God, you can't really complain about good and evil. All you can say is that you don't like something. What do I mean by that? Well, good or evil means there's some sort of standard. And if you say, well, this is my standard, I don't think this is right, so I'll call it evil, and yet I call it good, you'll bump up against somebody who has a different standard. Think about Adolf Hitler. What did he do? Was the gassing of 6 million Jews an evil? He saw it as a good. So he had his standard, you have your standard. It's just a clash of standards. All you can say is, I didn't like the fact that Hitler killed 6 million Jews. And Hitler's going to say, so what? I don't care what you like. It was good for the nation. It was good for me. It rid us of the Jewish tainted blood in our society so we could set up our good Aryans and have racial supremacy. Well, we think that's crazy. But we can only call things good or evil if there's a standard outside of the human race, that there actually is absolute good, absolute standard someplace. Now, where does that come from? Well, the Bible says it comes because there is the supernatural realm of God. God has established the good and the evil, and therefore we can talk about it. So when you hear somebody say something like, I'd never believe in God because of so much evil in the world. So you ask them, really, you think there's evil, or is it just something you don't care for? No, it's really evil. Well, we're back to that good and evil standard business, aren't we? So religious orientation, that truth comes from God, the idea of good and evil, he has the standards, there's a supernatural world, we have a soul. That's what the Bible says. That's a part of its religious orientation, that we are a body-soul kind of being. Yes, we have a physical body, and when we die, it goes in the ground, but the Bible talks about the soul living on, even in the Old Testament, but more so in the New Testament, that there is some afterlife to which we can go to. More on religious orientation. The Bible values prayer. It says it's not just babbling to yourself. You're actually connecting to this supernatural world. And of course, religious orientation, how about God's actions? He's intervening in this world. He's performing miracles, or he's talking to people to carry out particular activities that he has in mind. So let's go back. We got one story, one single story. We have a religious orientation that the book takes. How about themes? All through the Bible, there are certain set themes that come up again and again. For example, what does it say about God? Well, that he's a good God, that he's a creator God, that he seeks connection to people. I mean, we could go on and on, but there's a certain God that is represented. So the themes about how a God is. What is the theme about the human race? Well, that we are noble, we were created in God's image, so therefore we can do some wonderful things. And the Bible has some great stories of sacrifice and love and courage and things like that. However, the Bible also says one of the themes is that mankind is broken. And therefore we have somebody like David who could do all these tremendous things for God and yet kill people, be cruel within his own family, and cause all sorts of suffering. So let's continue. Other themes. Does it say something about evil and suffering? Yes. Where does it come from? Not from God. He's not a God bringing evil and suffering into the world. It's nature, and the human race has fallen. Well, the human race has fallen, and it's tainted nature. So that's one of the themes. Where is evil coming from? It comes from inside of us. It's not an exterior thing. It's not that society has set up some bad forms and we just need to break those down. No, the theme is that within us, we are to blame for every problem. It reminds me of a story. I think it was around 1900, a London newspaper sent out notes to a lot of prominent thinkers asking them what was wrong with the world. And G.K. Chesterton, a Christian apologist and writer, famous one at the time, sent his note back. And remember, the question was, what's wrong with the world? And people are writing these extensive pieces of information about why they think the world is screwed up. His answer, what's wrong with the world? Two words, I am. That's powerful. What's another theme? Well, there's a theme about the past, the intervention of God, that he does intervene, that he created. There are themes about the future. Things may be messed up now, but they will be okay later on. Themes about God's promises that he makes and his fulfillment of those promises. So again, one story, a religious orientation, all these things keep the Bible unified. The themes are repeated throughout, so that holds the Bible together. And then the Bible is self-referential. What do I mean by that? You can go several places in the Bible that echo other places in the Bible, and they connect. That allows the whole Bible to pull together as one tight body. Again, unity. For example, the idea of creation, the idea of Adam and Eve. Jesus mentioned that. Paul mentioned that. It's throughout Old Testament. How about the fall of man, the failure to live up to the commands of God? We see that all through the Bible. How about the covenant established with the children of Israel at Mount Sinai? We see that all through the Bible. Remember, we looked at, for example, the defense of Stephen when he was being set up to be put to death. He was the first martyr in the church. We read about this in the book of Acts. What does he do? He tells the history, and he takes them all the way back to the Old Testament. How about the Exodus, the idea of coming out under Moses? Moses gets a lot of play throughout the Bible. How about the idea of the monarchy and the kingship of David? Is David a big player throughout the rest of the Bible? You bet. How about the coming into exile, the way the people lost their land and went into exile? Is much mentioned throughout the Old Testament, not just one time, not just in the history books? Definitely. How about Jesus? Well, he ties together the entire New Testament, doesn't he? And in fact, the four gospel writers attempt to tie Jesus into the Old Testament. They look for references, biblical passages, messianic promises, and say this was Jesus. How about Paul? Does he tie things in? Yes, I've already mentioned that. revelation. I forgot what the percent is. I'm going to guess, and I think I'm pretty close to this, between 50 and 60% of the book of Revelation is referencing Old Testament people or events or symbols or whatever. But the connection there from the beginning to the end. In fact, at the end of Revelation, if I can, wasn't planning on doing this, so give me a second. If you look at the very end of Revelation, okay, it says, this is chapter 22, then the angel showed me the river of the water of life as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. This is the new Jerusalem that he's describing here. On each side of the river stood the tree of life. Does that sound familiar? Sure. That was Genesis. So we've got this self-referential thing going. Here's one more thing that makes the Bible connect and hold together. It's called archetypes. A-R-C-H-E-T-Y-P-E-S. Archetypes. The Bible is full of archetypes. So what am I talking about here? Well, give me a second. I want to do a little psychology. Carl Jung said that our unconscious mind, our, meaning the whole human race, the unconscious mind has links to everybody who ever lived, as far as their memories go. He called that the collective unconscious. So in other words, you and I, somehow buried away, we're not aware of it, can call up memory. Well, we can't call them up, but they're buried in there. We have these memories of what it was like to be in the Middle Ages, what it was like to be in prehistoric times. And some stories that we hear reproduce these memories. They resonate with us. They have a huge impact. And so I'm just going to run through a list of things here and tell me if you think, oh yeah, those are really common. They keep coming up. Their archetypes are patterns that recur over time. In other words, they happened at the beginning of the human race, and they were so impactful that we've passed them along in this collective unconscious. Now, I'm not saying I buy into that necessarily, but there is something powerful about these characters and images and plots that I'm going to mention in just a second that are done again and again and again because they have such an emotional connection to us. They resonate within us. Well, let's take, for example, characters. What are basic characters that we see again and again and again? Well, we see tempters and temptresses. We see the virtuous wife. We see bride and groom characters. We see innocent child stories. Kings and rulers. Priests. Wise persons and fools, shepherds, traders. How about pilgrims or wanderers? How about scapegoats? You see, all those characters, you probably right now can think of stories that have involved those things. I'm going to come up with some examples in just a few minutes. But so those are some of the characters that happen again and again and again in stories. What images, what sights do stories depend on again and again for strength? Well, how about darkness and light? How about food staples like bread? How about animals, particular animals showing strength or connection to the human race, or even ones that are harmful? How about the landscape, things like gardens and valleys and forests and groves of trees? How about plants like vineyards and weeds? What about buildings, temples, palaces, towers, prisons? How about the inorganic world, stones and jewelry and fire and rocks? How about images of water, rivers, springs, rainstorms, pools, seas? How about forces of nature, storms, wind, rain, spring? Time of rebirth. All right, then what about plots? Typical storylines that have happened again and again throughout human history. Here's one, the quest story. Somebody goes out to get something or to find something. How about fall from innocence stories? Somebody is in the world and then something is revealed to that individual and they go, oh, so that's the way it is. It's not the way I thought. There's a lot more evil out there. How about stories of rescue? How about death followed by rebirth as a single story plot? How about initiation into a harsh world? What about journey stories? Not necessarily quests, but just journeys. How about crime and punishment stories? Temptation stories? Epiphany stories. Epiphany is one of those things where it's just like a light bulb going off and you go, aha. How about sibling rivalry stories? So now, I've given you characters, I've given you images, I've given you plots. Can you think of specific stories that share some of these values and you would see as archetypes? Let you think for just a second here. Here are some that come to my mind. Oedipus Rex. There's an epiphany, isn't there? The Odyssey. The Wanderings. The Greek myths. That probably fits under several of these categories. Shakespearean stories. Fairy tales. American Westerns. Mark Twain stories. Detective and spy stories that are so popular. Soap operas. Think about soap operas. The virtuous person versus the wicked woman or the wicked man. We get a lot of those, don't we? The wise person or the fool. How about Lord of the Rings? Extremely popular stories. You could just go down the list here and just about check off everything. The quest story, isn't it? Death and rebirth stories. Narnia. The C.S. Lewis stories of Narnia have many of these characters and images and plots. Science fiction does. So it doesn't have to be a story set in the past or in some ancient world or something. It could be a story set in the future. So the Bible is full of these kinds of stories. Think about the fall from innocence. Well, we have the fall, don't we? We have death and rebirth. We've got the Jesus story. We've got journeys, the children of Israel on the way from Egypt to their promised land. We get crime and punishment stories. We get epiphany about Paul and the road to Damascus, and Jesus says to him, I'm the one you've been after, and he changes his ways. Think about how many images of light and dark are in the Bible. Bread, Jesus says he's the bread. Stories of vineyards are in the Bible. Temples are in the Bible. Tower of Babel is in the Bible. Stones and jewelry, that's mentioned much in Revelation. Lots about rivers. Lots about kings and heroes and villains and wise people and fools and shepherds are in the Bible and wanderers and scapegoats and on and on. So that's another way that the Bible is unified, because we see those throughout the Bible, and frankly we see it throughout all literature. So let's go over one more time. The Bible is unified because it tells one story, because it's religiously oriented, because the themes are the same, it references other parts of itself, it has archetypes, and then finally, one other way the Bible is unified is its style. All the way through the Bible, you can find, despite all these different authors, it shares some characteristics. It's concrete. What do I mean by that? It gives you sights and sounds and smells and touch and taste. It tries to immerse you in the real world. It's simple. It's not complicated. It's not hard to read. Now, the ideas may be difficult, but it's simple as far as the style goes. It has these archetypes as part of its style. It's brief. In other words, it's what we would say is understated. You know, what do I mean by that? It doesn't give us all the information. It doesn't get flowery. It doesn't over-talk particular scenes. So when we read about Abraham and Isaac, we don't find out how Abraham felt the night before, if he wrestled with this, and what he said or did not say to his wife. He just simply gets up in the morning and he goes off with Isaac. So these are brief stories. And frankly, because they are brief, they remind me a little bit of Ernest Hemingway stories. We have to bring our own emotions to it, and I think we do. It doesn't over-emotionalize anything, and so it allows us to consider grief and consider passions and to consider hatreds and all as we read about these stories. Another characteristic of the stories is often, since they were transmitted orally, we can hear the repetition, we can hear the kinds of rhythm that you would get into to try to remember these stories and pass them along. So one last time, literary unity of the Bible, one story, religiously oriented, the themes that are the same, referencing other parts of itself, the use of archetypes, and the style. All work together to keep this Bible from falling apart into 66 books. It sticks together very, very well. Well, you've gone through a lot of material here, but I hope this is just the springboard and the beginning for you. I don't want this to feel like the end. I want this to have made you curious enough to go back to reread portions of the Bible. For heaven's sakes, we did such a small amount of the Bible when we were going through these audio lectures. So go back. There's a lifetime of material that's in there. And if I can help you in any way or you want some extra information, feel free to email me, gzacharias@palomar.edu. My phone number is 760-744-1150. My extension is 2710. I'd love to talk to you about some of this. Yeah, I hope it's been a help to you. And I wish you well, and I hope you do continue reading the Bible. It's the foundation of the Western world and has much to offer you, even in this day and after this many years.